Well, good morning, everyone. It's hard to believe, hard for me to believe that it's Thursday already. You look forward to something and make your plans and get there and you think, my, we have a whole week and now we have a day. It's just unbelievable. I've enjoyed being here very, very much. I've enjoyed the food. Wasn't that dinner wonderful last night? My, that was incredible. And I've enjoyed, I'm on a special regimen, and it calls for eggs every morning. And I thought, well, I'm going to camp. They'll probably have eggs one morning, and then they'll have pancakes another and French toast another. So I bought a dozen eggs, and I thought I'll boil them, and then I'll have my eggs. And of all things, they have eggs made to order every morning. I couldn't believe it. I mean, this has been fantastic. And so I've enjoyed being here a lot. Some of you know I enjoy cycling, and I brought my bicycle, my famous folding bicycle. And I've been riding 10 miles each day. I'm kind of getting ready for a big ride in Texas. The last weekend of August, by the way, we're at camp. Have you looked at your watch? Do you know this is the beginning of August today? Great guns. Anyway, the end of August, I'm in a big ride. It's the biggest road ride in Texas. 17,000 people last year. It's called the Hotter Than Hell 100. Now, doesn't that sound great? They pick the hottest weekend of the year, they hope, and thousands of people who have no sense gather in a place that I have no idea why you'd go to Wichita Falls for any other reason. And I have dear friends there. Forgive me if this ever gets out. I've become a massage therapist, some of you know. So I call it my triple threat weekend. On Friday, I am part of the team, there are 25 of us, who do pre-ride sports massage, 20-minute increments. And then on Saturday, I take part in the ride. And then on Sunday, I preach at Grace Church, which is a wonderful church in Wichita Falls. And the staff members are all graduates of Dallas Seminary. And I've seen this church begin as a Bible study in a beautiful home, and now it has 2,000 or 3,000 members. It's an incredible place. Anyway, so I've been riding my bike, and this reminds me, I've told some of you years ago about a bicycle accident that I sustained in 2001. That led to major brain surgery. Here is Dr. Swindoll visiting me at Medical City in Dallas following the surgery. Here's my dear wife, Beverly. This is right after 9/11, so you see I'm wearing my Taliban party hat. And the aftermath of brain surgery was constant head pain. My surgery was 2001, and I still wake up in the morning with my head hurting. This morning I woke up at 2:45 and was unable to go back to sleep because of my head pain. Well, I haven't had a massage all week. I have one this afternoon. And I found that massage is the one way I can relieve my head pain, getting massage, which I'll do this afternoon. But then, it's a long story, my massage therapist encouraged me to go to massage school, which is the dumbest thing I've ever been told by anyone. I told her, seminary professors do not go to massage school. But she talked me into it, and I did. I went to a school in Dallas called Hands On, and I found on the fifth week, unexpectedly, that doing massage relieves my head pain almost as effectively as getting it. It has to do with pain trigger mechanism, And that was explained to me by a professor at Harvard who deals with pain issues and ways of dealing with it. And he says, I'm paid $600 an hour to work with professional athletes, and you figured it out by going to massage school. And here's the director of the clinic, who was such a wonderful asset to me. And I got so involved in doing massage, I decided I'd like to do more than just what is taught for licensure. And so I've taken more hours after I got my license than it took to get it, including going to Thailand, where I could learn Thai massage, which is entirely different than American Swedish massage. Thai massage is done on a mat on the floor. No lotion is used because the recipient is clothed, and it's all pressure point, very strictly done, and some crazy stretches. And this is a wonderful stretch. This is my teacher in Thailand, in Chiang Mai, 10 years ago. Her name is Ra Tree, and I still remember her with great affection. So for years, I've worked at a massage clinic in Dallas. Evenings, I work from 5 to 9, and I give massages, and I'm able to teach the next day without terrible pain, which has been a gift from God, and it's given me some wonderful experiences. Well, just last month, I went back to Thailand. I was scheduled to be in Hong Kong, where I preached at a very famous church, the Yang Phun Phuc Church. That's a church that is the sponsor of Dallas Seminary in China. We have 19 graduates of Dallas Seminary who are on the staff of this very large, multi-thousand member church. And I've spoken before there and love that place. And I spoke just 3 weeks ago to the English-speaking congregation this time. And from Hong Kong to Thailand is only a $300 round-trip ticket. So I went to Thailand and did some fun things, including going back to the Thai massage school in Chiang Mai, 400 miles north of Bangkok, and enrolled in another class, one I hadn't taken. And here I'm getting my certification. By the way, like doctors and technicians and educators, massage therapists also have to take continuing education. So this certification will satisfy my state requirement in Texas. And then I did something really, really fun, I thought. I'd been getting massage while I was in Chiang Mai in a clinic, and I'd gotten foot massage from a lovely lady, and I told her that I was doing this class in reflexology and Thai foot massage, and I asked her manager, if I pay the fee for an hour, may I give your therapist foot massage, which I did, and that was so much fun to have my therapist, who's a professional Thai foot massage therapist, be my client. And that's just wild. Isn't that fun? So I had a wonderful time there before coming here. So now we're going to go back to the book of Amos, but I thought I'd just bring you kind of up to date on these things. In chapter 5, there's a paragraph that mentions the concept of the day of the Lord. It begins in verse 16. The day of the Lord is something that is developed especially in the biblical books of Joel and Zephaniah. But we have it here in Amos as well. Joel and Zephaniah speak to the southern kingdom of Judah 100 years and more after the time of Amos. But here we have Amos announcing the day of the Lord to Israel, the northern kingdom. And just a comment on this, the day of the Lord, Yom Adonai, is a phrase that involves an extended period of time in which God is unusually present in the lives of his people, either for overwhelming blessing or for terrible judgment. I'll say that again. This is a polished and refined definition. The day of the Lord is an extended period of time in which God is unusually present with his people. Day of the Lord is for the people of God. Either for overwhelming blessing or for terrible judgment. And sadly, I report that the day of the Lord here is the judgmental. And what Amos is predicting is the coming of the Assyrians. He joins Hosea and Jonah in their combined revelation that trouble's coming, and the trouble's coming from the Assyrians, and it will be overwhelmingly devastating. And in verse 21, we read that Yahweh rejects their syncretistic worship. And remember, that was the besetting sin of the northern kingdom from the very beginning, when Jeroboam the first effected the secession of the northern tribes. He kept that in place by replacing their worship in Jerusalem with worship in their own country, in their own boundaries, which was a brilliant act of statecraft, but a horrible thing in terms of the pure religion of God. Because at the two rival shrines, as I mentioned earlier, he brought about syncretism, the worship of Baal, along with Yahweh. And in that, we have the horrors that finally lead to the destruction of the northern kingdom. Along the way in this passage, there's a marvelous phrase that was picked up by Martin Luther King Jr. Let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Dr. King loved the prophets, and he found some very remarkable verses to use in his own preaching. One of the assignments I give my students when they take the course in prophets, this is an optional, they have 20 options, but one is to read or listen now online to three of Dr. King's messages that quote from the prophets, and then write responses to them. And I have found that some of my black students have never themselves heard or read these great messages from Martin Luther King. They know the name, and it's a part of their cultural heritage in a sense, but it's not something they've ever done themselves. And I get some wonderful papers. I say that because I just read one yesterday. I'm grading papers well here too, as they come in online. Now then, the next big section of the book is a series of visions. And there are three visions, and then two more. And in between this series of five visions is a biographical section of conflict with the priest at Bethel, the temple in the southern part of the land where Amos has come to announce the judgment of God. And his name is Amaziah. So I'm just going to mention the visions. One is locusts, and you know about locusts from reading the story of the Exodus and one of the plagues against the Egyptians. By the way, in Thailand, they have locusts. As their locusts in other places, I'm sure different species. But one day on a bicycle ride, a five-day bicycle ride in Thailand, I was really, really hot. It's really hot in Thailand. I'm getting ready for Wichita Falls. It's really hot there. And I was worn out, and we still had 15 miles to go. And our Thai guide looked at me and he says, "Ron, it looks like you could use a little boost." And I said, "Yeah, I'm about sapped out." And he said, "Well, I have a suggestion. The next village, they sell a snack. And I love to go through this town because they have a great snack." So I said, "All right, I'm game." And we pulled into this village. There were about a dozen of us. And he says, "Now, Ron, we've been together several days. Do you trust me?" And I thought, uh-oh. And I said, I guess. And he said, well, what I want you to do is to open your mouth, and I'm going to put something in. I don't want you to look. And I want you to take a bite and chew. And foolishly, I opened my mouth. Because as a missionary, I've learned where he leads me, I will follow. And what he feeds me, I'll swallow. So I opened my mouth, and he put something in, and he says, all right. And I felt kind of an odd sensation in my mouth with all sorts of poking things and sticky-like things. And he says, all right, chew. And I chewed down, and well, one, it was salty, and that was really good, because when you perspire a lot, have you ever been with cyclists on a really hot day? You know, we wear these indecent black spandex bicycling shorts, and when you're riding, you know, unless you're the leader, you see the same sight. You see the backside of another rider, right? And when it's really, really hot, in which it all falls, you see this all the time, you see this white marking coming down the middle of their shorts as salt is being drawn out by the perspiration. So it tasted salty and good, and I opened my mouth, and I said, what is this? He says, roasted grasshoppers. And they were delicious. And I realized that John the Baptist ate the same sort of thing, roasted grasshoppers, and they're full of protein and salty, and they were great. So locusts that have been roasted and are put in a plastic bag can be a really good thing, but locusts that are swarming over your country and destroying vegetation aren't so good at all. And then warning visions of fire and a plumb line, and both of these things are a part of the prophetic bag of tricks. But the thing that is, I don't mean tricks in a silly way, but I mean the way to get attention. But the thing that is really impressive to me is his conflict with Amaziah. And here is an actual digital photo. No, it's not. It's just an artist's illustration of Amos being confronted by the priest Amaziah. This is verse 17 in chapter 7. Says, Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, the king of Israel, saying, so this is a letter that he wrote, and this letter was sent as an official missive. It would have been written on perhaps on clay, and there would have been a signet seal on it, and perhaps it was written on papyrus, the Egyptian way, but probably on clay. And it was sent to the palace in Samaria. And it reads, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. This man Amos has come from Judah, and he's come up here to speak against you. And the land is not able to hear all his words. That is, we're sick of it. And then Amos has said, he tells him, that Jeroboam shall die by the sword. Well, that's sedition. He's threatening the death of the king. And Israel shall surely be led away captive from their own land. So no wonder the priest is angry, and the king is going to be furious. So then Amaziah said to Amos, now get out of here and go back to Judah. Eat there and prophesy there, but cease to speak here. You're not welcome. We don't want you. Who invited you? Never again prophesy at Bethel, for it's the king's sanctuary. It's the royal residence of Jeroboam. What are you thinking that you'd come here? And you might think that Amaziah would receive the apology of Amos. Not so much. Amos responds to him with a violent message of judgment. He answered and said to Amaziah, you know, I'm not a professional prophet. This isn't really my job. When he says, I'm not the son of a prophet, he's not there speaking about his father, because the office of prophet was not hereditary. It isn't that if your father's a prophet, you'll be a prophet, as in the case if your father's a king, you might become king. Now, what he's talking about is the prophetic guild. Young men in ancient Israel, if there was no room for them on the farm, would be indentured to master craftsmen sometimes, to silversmiths, to goldsmiths, to workers in leather, maybe as scribes, and they would become a part of a guild. And there were those who had a heart for God that would be indentured to a guild of prophets. And the leader of the guild would be called the father, and the members of the guild would be called sons. So when he says, I was not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, that means that he was never a member even of a prophetic guild. He had no training in what he has done, but God came to him as he was breeding sheep and as he was dressing sycamore fruit. There's a note about that in the handouts, this business about the fruit. And he said, I want you to go and do a special mission just for me. This non-prophet became a prophet. This sheep breeder became a messenger of Yahweh. He joined for a brief period the ranks of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. He became a prophet for a short period of time, given a journey to take with a message to a foreign land, to the northern kingdom of Israel. And Yahweh took me, verse 15, as I followed the flock, and he said to me, go prophesy, now look at these words, to my people Israel. So even in the last days of the northern kingdom, God still regards them as his people. The Hebrew word used in Torah about the special nature of Israel is sigula, God's particular special possession. Here you have someone who has all things, wealth beyond imagination. This is God. But he regards one thing as his most special possession, and that one thing is his people. And his people are not just in Jerusalem and Judah. His people are in Samaria and Dan and Bethel and all the tribes of the northern kingdom. 10 tribes. 10 tribes of 12. The majority of his people. The majority of the land. All coming under judgment. And this is sort of a last-ditch move by God to rescue them from the day of the Lord in judgment. Go prophesy to my people Israel. Now then, he says to the priest, hear the word of Yahweh. You say, don't prophesy against Israel, do not spout against the house of Isaac. Well, this is what the Lord has to say to you, old buddy. Your wife will become a harlot in the city. How could that happen? Because with his death, the king's death, and with the destruction of the palace, she'll have no more resources, and she'll be reduced to prostitution just to eat. And your sons and daughters will die by the sword. Your land will be divided by survey line, and you yourself will die in the defiled land, so that the king will either die in situ, in place, in Israel, or he'll be among those carried off into captivity, because Israel will surely be led away captive from his own land. And this is the most serious judgment of all. I told you it's all according to the book. When God spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, God told Moses, "You tell this to the people, that I have a provision of great blessing for you. It is my covenant. It's my interactive, interrelational covenant. It is going to be wonderful if you're faithful, but it's going to be absolutely horrible if you break it. And you're now in breach of covenant. And before I've cut off rain, before I've had nations buffet your borders, but nothing has helped. And it's been almost 200 years from the days of Jeroboam the first. And finally, it's coming on you. And a nation is going to come. Turns out it's the Assyrians. And they're going to destroy your nation. They're going to set siege to your cities. They're going to set siege to Samaria. And they're going to take your children, beautiful boys and beautiful girls, and they're going to rape and sodomize them. They're going to take your wives, your women, your young women, and they're going to make them playthings for the soldiers. They're going to take your strong sons and make them slaves. And they're going to take others, and they're going to kill them brutally." The Assyrians were the most vicious peoples of the ancient Near East. They bragged about their viciousness. They bragged about their barbarity, both in word and in picture. At the Hebrew Museum in Jerusalem, one of the great archaeological museums of the world, of course, there is an exact copy of the bas-relief that Sennacherib had erected in his palace in Nineveh when he returned from defeating the Jews in the war in 701 at Lachish, and where he was unsuccessful in destroying Jerusalem. He had to cover for himself that his army was destroyed, so he made much of the one victory he had, which was against Lachish. And this is 40 feet long, perhaps. It's all bas-relief. It's all in stone. And it ranges in height from 8 feet to 12 feet. And it has cartoons of every particular segment of the battle against the city and the massive munitions, the armor of the archers, the way in which they not only traveled with equipment and with chariots and with arrows and bows and all the machinery to set siege to a city, but they even traveled with hairdressers. And before battle, the commanding units of the army would have their beards and hair done. They'd have a spa day because they were so confident of victory that they wanted to be celebrated as the great people that they were. And the figures of the Judean defenders are diminutive in size against the exaggerated size of the attackers. And then what happened to those who were left after the defeat? Huh. It has images of them being pinned to the ground, prone, that's face down, and the skin flayed from their backs, and then turned and pinned now supine, and their genitals cut, and stuck in their mouths, and a Y incision like on CSI, and their intestines stretched out as far as it would go. And then when the person finally dies in the sun, in agony, the body is put on a post with a sharpened stick up the rectum or through the abdomen to be there as sort of a gruesome lollipop in the sun for birds to come and feast on. The Assyrians were the most wretched people in warfare in the ancient world. And they're the ones who came and destroyed the northern kingdom. It was absolutely beyond words, beyond imagination, the suffering of the people. And they're the same ones who came to destroy Jerusalem in 701, and God defeated them. So this confrontation is a very personal thing, and Amos would never forget standing before the priest, who presumed himself to be priest of God, but who was priest of Baal more than God, and he told him his sorry end. There come a couple of more images, and chapter 8 is the vision of summer fruit. Now, frankly, this used to puzzle me. God says, "What do you see?" And he says, "I see a basket of summer fruit." Now, to me, person who grew up in Southern California, there's nothing more wonderful than fruit in the summer. And to me, a basket of summer fruit would be wonderful. But because of the words that follow, we recognize, oh, this isn't fruit that's just been picked and that's fresh. But this is fruit that's left over and wasn't eaten. This is fruit that is now rotted and become filled with bugs and insects and stench. And it's that which was not usable anymore. And then chapter 9, verses 1 to 6, visions at the altar. And here is the altar reconstructed at Tel Dan, way to the north. Amos came to Bethel, but Bethel is a modern city filled with buildings and life and people. It's called Beitin. It's in the West Bank. So there's no archaeology done there, but the twin city way in the north was excavated over a period of 10 years by a master Israeli archaeologist, Avraham Biran. I got to know him and interview him about his work there. And at the very pinnacle of the site, at the Acropolis, was the pagan Yahwistic center, this syncretistic cult center. And what he wanted to do was to build an altar that was grander than the one in Jerusalem, because he wanted to tell the people, going here to worship, it's not second best, it's better than there. And if you can see in this cluttered picture, metal structure. Dr. Biran did not want to rebuild the altar because he had a proper Jewish view of the wretchedness of that, but he wanted visitors to the site to get an impression of how huge it was. So based on the foundation, he built a metal frame that would show how large the altar actually was. And then there were steps leading up to that where priests could lead animals up for the sacrifice on the top of that altar. And you see the metal horns at the four corners. That was in mockery of what was done in Jerusalem. When an animal was sacrificed, a rope around the animal's neck would loosely be draped around one of these horns at the side of the altar as a way of tying the animal, as it were, to the altar as a symbol of the significance of the death of that animal and its subsequent burning. And it's at this altar and the one at Bethel where Amos was that the indecencies were done of joining the worship of God to the worship of Baal. And this is absolutely horrible. Verse 5, let's see. Verse 5, the Lord God of hosts, he who touches earth and it melts, and all who dwell there mourn, all of it shall swell like the river and subside like the river of Egypt. He's talking about the annual inundation of the Nile. And he who builds his layers in the sky and has founded strata on the earth, who calls the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. Yahweh is his name. Are you not like the people of Ethiopia to me? The word Ethiopia is now understood to be Cush. This is a new idea. Bible translators saw the word Cush, and they didn't know that that was an exacting term. So they knew it was in Africa, and they just made up that it was Ethiopia. But now we know that the Hebrew word Cush means Cush, and that it is the people of the area south of Egypt in what is now southern Sudan. And the ancient Cushites had an enormously successful civilization in the mid-third millennium BC that rivaled anything in Mesopotamia, one of the great cultures of the ancient world, and totally lost to us. We've only known this for about 10 years. And so now, newer translations are substituting Cush for the word Ethiopia. And then a concluding announcement of disaster in verses 7 to 10. The eyes of the Lord Yahweh are on the sinful kingdom. And this is not in pleasure. It's in judgment. That's why he talks about Cush, Ethiopia. Now, we have a huge change in chapter 9. And I'm not swearing. I'm saying thank God that the book doesn't end in verse 10. But the sinners will die by the sword. But there's verse 11 through 15, two promises of future deliverance. Now, you have to put yourself in the period of time. The prophets of the Old Testament world, the prophets of God, true prophets, always had three audiences. Among the hearers of the prophets were always the remnant of the righteous. That's what Elijah learned at Mount Sinai. God asks Elijah after the victory at Mount Carmel and then the disaster at Jezreel, as he learned that though God had displayed himself to be Yahweh and God alone, that Jezebel would have nothing to do with that. And as far as she was concerned, nothing changed. So we read in the book of Kings, chapter 19, Elijah then knew. And what did he know? He knew that nothing had changed. And he was a broken man, and he fled because, well, he wanted to die. He didn't want Jezebel to have the pleasure of being the instrument of his death. But he ran as far as he could, and he journeyed all the way down through the southern kingdom, past Beersheba, the southernmost point, and out under a desert shrub. He says, "It's enough now, Lord, take my life." And he fell asleep with exhaustion. And then the next day, he's awakened by none other but the Lord himself. I believe it's an appearance of Jesus, pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, called the angel of Yahweh, Malach Adonai. And he fed him twice and then sent him on a journey all the way down to Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, Elijah is asked by God, as he's standing in the very niche in the rock where Moses had been. I've written on this. I'm summarizing a technical article in a sentence. But he was in the very niche in the rock where Moses had been. And God says to him, "What are you doing here?" And to elicit from his own mouth. And he says, "I and I alone have been faithful to God." And God says, "Well, as a matter of fact, I still have 7,000 people in the northern kingdom. This is 850, 100 years before Amos, who are still faithful to me, who have not kissed the image of Baal. By the way, no little kids around. They would kiss a phallic symbol. We have hundreds of these that have been discovered by archaeologists. They would kiss a symbol of the sexuality represented by the god Baal. He says, I have 7,000 haven't done that. There are always righteous, even in the days of Amos. And they would hear these words and they'd be grieved and they'd pray, oh God, will you lead our people to forgiveness? Will you please bring about revival among our people? Then the larger number of those who know God and have turned away from him. And that's why the principal verb in the prophets is shuv, return. Return to me and I'll return to you. And then the third group were those who were utterly lost. They needed to be saved. But these words actually would comfort the believers that one day in the far and distant future, long after we're all gone, one day the Lord is going to return to planet Earth. This is the second coming. One day he's going to return. He's going to establish his kingdom. And the way things are today, the kingdom is, the royal family is like a shanty in a field. The Hebrew word for that is sukkah, a temporary building in the field used by harvesters just to get out of the sun in the middle of the day for a break that they can have lunch and water and then go back to work. And the great kingdom of David, which God promised would be eternal, is broken. There are only two tribes are still being led by a Davidic descendant. And here the larger number, it's like the whole thing is a shanty. But one day I'm going to rebuild. It's going to be grander than ever. And they'll possess the remnant of Edom and all the Gentiles who are called by my name. Look at that word in verse 12. Because the coming of King Jesus will not only be for Jews, but it'll be for all the families of the earth. Because God's intentionality was always global. Genesis 12, the blessing of God on Abraham was to the end that all the families of the earth will find their blessing through him. And verse 13, behold, days are coming, matches verse 11. On that day, these are the sigla that readers of the prophets learn to recognize, speaking of eschatology, of end time events. This was not something in their lifetime, nor in their children's lifetime. This is at the end of time. The days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, those who take care of seed. There will be an abundance of wine and of grain. The kingdom is described in agrarian terms. Why is that? Because the people were agrarian. The people were farmers, and we know what they farmed. We have the species of the land given in Deuteronomy. Two grains, barley and wheat, and then there's the grape for wine. And then there are three fruits, the fig and the pomegranate and the date. And then there's the olive for oil. And imagining wine coming in such abundance that it's as though the mountains are dripping with wine and the hills flowing with it. And I'll bring the captives of my people back and they'll build waste cities and re-inhabit them and they'll plant their vineyards and drink from them and they will make gardens and eat fruit from them and I will plant them in their land. Oh, that is so powerful. The planting will not only be of gardens and vineyards and the seeding of soil for the growing of grain. The big thing God's going to do is replant his people because the kingdom is going to be made principally for the Jewish people to fulfill the promises that God has promised. The prophet Amos traveled from Tekoa in Judah to Bethel to present Yahweh's Reeve oracle, this broken covenant message against Israel. This is an attack on Israel in the days of Jeroboam the second, 755, 760 is the peg date. The people of Israel were guilty of many sins. Preeminently, they'd perverted justice. They'd made holy acts of worship mere external actions. They'd participated in pagan, idolatrous acts. But God has not given them up forever. He has promises for their future. And the book of Amos is infused with Yahweh's passion for justice and his strong demands that his people practice true worship and demonstrate a singular affection for him and for him alone. Our Father, we recognize that in reading the book of Amos, we're in a different world than the one in which we live, a more simple world, a more focused world. And here we are in the modernity that overwhelms us with all of its surprises and all of its newness and all of its unexpectedness. And yet we, like the people of Israel of old, we are people of need. We are people who commit sin. We are people who wander from righteousness. We are people who often do not live up to the hope that is within us. And we ask that as we read these ancient words, we would reflect on our own lives, that we would be people who would reflect more regularly, more routinely, more commonly, your goodness in a bent and twisted generation. And then we are so grateful that even with Israel, in its worst days, you still offered an opportunity for forgiveness, an opportunity for a return, an opportunity for new blessing. And we're grateful that you are a good, good God, and your mercy overwhelms your judgment, and that even when there is judgment, you're not done, and blessing lies before all of us as we have the enjoyment of relationship with Jesus today, and we have the expectation of the return of King of Glory to planet Earth to establish that kingdom for which the prophets longed so deeply. So thank you for our time here. I thank you for the opportunity given me to be here. And we ask your blessing on these facilities. We're so excited at the prospect of the new use of new land and new buildings and new hopes and new ministries. And we ask that you will do your work here in the future as you do your work in our hearts today. In Jesus' name, amen.